Well, Gwinnett Church, Hamilton Hill, and Sugar Hill, can we welcome Sandra and Andy Stanley with us today?
Thank you.
We're so honored that y'all are here. And today we're in this series, Hashtag Goals, and you probably have a vacation goal or a retirement goal or career goal. And today we're talking about relationship goals because we all have relationships and we all want them to work. And so Wendy and I have been greatly influenced by Sandra and Andy. So we're going to talk about marriage and parenting and family. But before all that happens, we'd love to hear, you know, we get to see you on the screen, Andy, but we don't get to see you very much, Sandra. So we're so thrilled that you're here. So we'd love to hear a little bit about your story, your kids, and where you are in your season of life.
Yeah, let's see.
You tell them your version.
My version? The real version. Yeah. Andy and I have been married, this past summer was 30 years.
Wow.
So 30 years is a big one.
Awesome.
We have three kids. Andrew is 26, Garrett's 24, Allie's 23. Garrett's 25, actually, just had a birthday. And then we have a foster daughter, Maisie, and she is 19.
Yep.
And, yeah, that's...
And we, I know you'll be shocked to hear this, we met at a Bible study. Did you see the surprise look on their faces?
Pretty
now?
Cliche, yeah.
And cliche. Sandra was at Georgia Tech, and I was the guest grown-up speaker well into his career. Like, well
I wasn't
going to
say anything,
career.
But I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
I had gotten my braces off,
her on our first date, I said, because I was working with high school students, I said, have you ever worked with teenagers? She said, I just finished being one.
That's awesome.
That's right. It was my junior year, and he was the guest speaker. Our regular speaker was gone, and the tennis coach at Tech was a mutual friend of ours, and he basically harassed Andy into calling me and asking me out and
it just seems so tacky. Hi, I'm the Bible study teacher. Do you want to go out? That was like, it's not going to do that. So
that's great. So
Gary, only worship leaders
Gary
do
came
that.
Came to me
anyway,
and he
sorry.
Said, "What did you?"
That was terrible.
He said, "What did you think about Andy?" And I said, "That was the best message I've ever heard in my life." So I start telling him about the message and what I learned and how great it was. He said, "No, I mean, what did you think of Andy?" And I said, "Well, how old is he?"
It's like, hey, I know how you feel.
You know, yeah, like a man with a job. So
it worked out.
It worked out.
It did work out.
It did. And we're glad it did. And y'all have an amazing family. Mm-hmm. But let's back up to the beginning of marriage. And I think one of the more challenging things with marriage is we come into it with expectations. And so talk about what are some fair expectations to have, some goals, and some of the challenges that you guys had and the expectations that you brought into your marriage.
I expected marriage to be hard. Mm-hmm. And I expected it was just going to be hard, and I'd never seen a marriage that I wanted to have, but I fell in love, oh darn, and so I, you know, I wanted to marry Sandra, but I really went in thinking, okay, this is going to be tough, because I'd seen my parents since about 10th grade for me just fight, they fought with each other, but they fought for their marriage and with each other, and then it didn't work, and they were both Christians and both, you know, knew the scripture. So I just thought, okay, I'm in love and I want to marry her and I expected it to be hard.
Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, expected it to be easy because my parents had a pretty easy marriage. They were very compatible and that was all I'd ever seen. Both of them, I still had all four of my grandparents. They had great marriages. So for me, there was an expectation that it would be easy. And you know, I think we all bring expectations into our marriages. I think for us though, we more had expectations for ourselves. I had an expectation, having watched my mom model marriage, an expectation of what I thought I should be as a wife. Mm-hmm. He kind of had the same thing. And actually, we grew up in homes with very similar values and all of that. So we brought the same picture of all of that, which made it a little bit easier for us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a lot healthier when you have expectations for yourself rather than putting your expectations on the other person, you know, expectations for them. And, you know, those are the not healthy kind of expectations when we come in and start loading up our spouse with things that we just expect them to do and be and right, all that.
And expectations always feel like a weight. Mm-hmm. You know, even when you have expectations for yourself, it just feels like a weight if you're trying to live up your own expectations, the other person's. And I think for me, my I had this picture of, okay, this is the kind of husband I'm going to be, and if I ever get to be a dad, this is the kind of dad. And I really was so focused on trying to do my part right that I carried sort of an inordinate weight to the point where I would always be checking in with her, almost like, how am I doing? How are you doing? How am I doing? How are you doing?
And she's like, really? I'm fine.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of
drove. I'll let you know.
Yeah. Because I was expecting there to be all this turmoil, and, you know, she's probably not telling me everything. And then it's,
and then one day it's going to be an explosion, you know, because she's burying it all down in there.
I just carried a picture from my growing up marriage into our marriage, which was unfair to her. So it accidentally put an expectation on her, which was kind of an odd expectation. But again, all expectations feel like weight, and I'll make this short. And the challenge with that is, when I put an expectation on you, I automatically shrink the margin of gratitude in our relationship, because we're rarely grateful for what we expect. And so the more I expect her to do certain things, then I'm going to be less and less grateful. And gratitude actually fuels generosity and fuels a relationship. So the problem with expectations is not that people shouldn't do things or fulfill their promises or their vows, certainly, but the weight of expectation, it just shrinks the margin of gratitude, shrinks the margin of love, generosity, intimacy, everything. So figuring out in a relationship early on how to, I'll own my expectations and I'll just love you and you own yours and love me, we finally got there. But we came in with different pictures and different expectations.
That's right. Andy's what he said about gratitude. He modeled gratitude in our relationship so much. He would thank me for things that were expectations I had for myself. And I'm like, you know, really, you don't have to thank me for everything. And but it really did set a tone for that, minimizing the expectations and being grateful, which I think is really huge as it relates to all of that.
She was, this sounds weird, she was normal. And I was expecting less. I just came in with sort of low expectations. So I really was genuinely grateful. And she was like, well, this is kind of what I'm, you know, what I am supposed to do. But, and the other thing real quick on the expectations front is, when we, in marriage, we're talking specifically about marriage. Mm-hmm. When we bump into the internal frustration because, the other person's not doing what we expect them to do, here's what I have learned to do, and this is just some advice since I'm up here, is, you know, I've learned for me, if I will stop, if I will pause and kind of do a gut check and get super specific and ask myself, okay, Andy, exactly what are you expecting from Sandra? Because unmet expectations feel like a cloud of emotion that's a cloud of frustration, and we rarely pinpoint it. We rarely condense it to something we can talk about, and then we let it build up and we say things like, well, I just don't feel like you love me. Or, you know, I don't feel like you want to be around me. Or we just, you know, something comes out. Well, how do you even talk about that? I mean, it's just like, okay. But it's, you know, so I've learned that when I sort of feel that internal frustration, which is so rare. she told me to say it is so rare. I've learned that if I will pause and I will ask myself, okay, Andy, exactly what are you expecting her to do? Or exactly what are you expecting her to be? And generally, if I will pause and make myself define it and kind of put a word around it, half the time I realize, Andy, that's silly, grow up. And then it gets so small that by the time I finally, you know, start the conversation, it's manageable, it's very specific. It's not this, well, I just feel. So there are going to be unmet. There's going to be frustration around expectations in marriage. I don't think that's avoidable. But if we can just pause long enough to own it and be very, very, very specific and begin those conversations with specifics as opposed to, I'm just, you know, in big emotions no one can respond to. And that's just sort of, and I didn't go into marriage knowing how to do that. This is something that I learned over time. But everybody can do that, I think.
That's, well, and I would just say that the idea too about if you minimize your expectations, the gratitude increases. That's a phenomenal principle. And another principle that I've learned from Andy and Sanders, unexpressed gratitude communicates ingratitude. So once you have that gratitude, to communicate that gratitude is really, really important. But I would like to stick on the theme of frustration. So when you have those frustrations, where do you take those frustrations, and how do you deal with that in a healthy way?
Sanders had far more experience in this than I have.
That's not true. That's not true. You know, I think in a lot of the circles that many of us navigate, we're told, take your frustrations to God, take your frustrations to God. And none of us know exactly what that means or what that is supposed to look like. It's not one of those things where we go to God and go, okay, God, here's what he did, and now let's just be mad at him together, you know. I think taking our frustrations to the Lord, which is I think is super important, is all about the regular rhythm of the time that we pull away from him daily, pulling away from the activities and all the stuff of life, and draw near to our Heavenly Father, just in that regular rhythm. And in that rhythm, when we're praying, when we're in Scripture, God does something in us, I think, that sort of minimizes that frustration. It's a little bit of what Andy was talking about. It's he works in our heart first, that by the time we go to have a conversation, which many times we need to have, it's minimized. We've recognized our part. God has shown us something that we need to work on. It just diffuses, I think, the frustration when in the regular rhythm of our everyday, we are pulling away and having time alone with our Heavenly Father, whether, you know, call it a quiet time or whatever. We are super aware that in different seasons of life, that looks different. My quiet time was so different when I had little kids at home than it is now. Different seasons are different, but in that regular rhythm of our day, when we pull away, it minimizes all of that. Not, it doesn't minimize our frustrations, but it certainly gives us direction and wisdom and ownership of our part and all of that, when God just meets us in that unique place, that unique posture of humility and just drawing near to our Heavenly Father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just add to that. And I think this is something that some of us were taught as kids to have a quiet time. I think most adults, it's not a habit. It is for us, but as I talk to friends, it's just a, and so what happens is, I'm convinced everybody needs a moment, I think every day, but 5 days a week, we need a rhythm or a habit, to Sandra's point, where the word I like to use is where we recenter our lives. And by that, I mean, we sort of decide, okay, what's important? What's most important? You know, where am I in the broad spectrum of things? I like to use the Lord's Prayer because my Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. I like your front and center, your will be done. You know, your will be done. My will is submitted to your will. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, in my world as it is in heaven. And I like to work through the Lord's Prayer. It recenters me. I'm dependent on you for my provision, my pardon, my protection. You are the great God. I'm the little speck that is here for just a second, here today and gone tomorrow. And to bring my marriage, kid, work, money, pressure, all of it into proper perspective allows me to better respond to what otherwise seems to be my whole world. So if you have children and you have one of your children who's just going through a tough time, I mean, we all know this, that becomes your whole world. In fact, to the point where, do I have other kids? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It just gets this big. Or if you're going through a tough season in your marriage, that thing just, it becomes your whole world. Well, it's not your whole world, and it's not the whole world. And having the daily routine of recentering, putting everything in perspective and not waiting until there's a crisis and start praying about my marriage. I just think for both of us, that has just been, that constant recentering prepares us, I think, to keep those things in perspective. And again, to ask the question, because if you're having a morning quiet time or a daily quiet time, you're asking in some capacity, God, what do you need to do in me? What do I need to do? How do I become a better person, a better follower in marriage, as a father, as a wife, a mom, whatever it might be? So that I think sets the stage for those big moments where we really have things to deal with. So the other thing too on this, and I stole this phrase from Marcus Buckingham from a book that he wrote years ago. He talked about this research with couples who went the distance, and he used the phrase, a generous explanation. And I love this, a generous explanation. And Sandra and I through the years, in fact, this research argues that every successful couple does this, whether they have words to explain it or not. They give each other a generous explanation. So when I find myself frustrated with her, my natural tendency, and you should tell, she has so many stories. She gives me a generous explanation all the time, including this week. We had an opportunity for a generous explanation. Seriously. And a generous explanation is, this is what I thought he was going to do, and this is what he did, and there's a gap, and we choose what we put in the gap. And successful couples choose to put to come up with or manufacture I bet this happened, or oh, I bet this, I'm gonna give him or give her the benefit of the doubt. I bet there's an explanation, instead of immediately just going to the negative. And when I read that in the book, I thought, we through the years have developed that habit, and because most of the time it's not as bad as we think, and the person's not evil and wants to be late and wants to frustrate, and so anyway, that
and our knee-jerk response isn't a generous explanation. Our knee-jerk response and our immediate response is, you know,
they did it again.
Did it again, or, you know, whatever. And it really is a habit to develop over time, and it is so worth it. It is so worth it. Another thing as it relates to all of this,
but they're wondering what I did this week.
So, oh, this week? Do we need to tell them?
I'll tell them, because
that was
when this
my next
happened,
question.
No, I know. When this happened, I thought, how can I be so stupid? So this was administrative assistance week.
So it was administrative assistance week, FYI, in case y'all missed it.
And Sandra went to all this trouble to get Diane and Darcy, who helped me just keep my life straight, these cool gifts, these pillows. And this has happened so many times. She puts them on the kitchen counter with a note. I'm gonna get all the credit at the office for this awesome work she's done. So what do? I walk off, and just leave them. It's like right. So when I get in the car, I'm almost there and I realize, oh, I've done it and I've done it again. And tell them what
you
do.
So what I need to do is barricade the door. That's right. Lesson learned. No, and so when I look at it, because I know him.
So she walks in the kitchen and there it is with the note, don't forget to take these. Right where she left it the night before.
But here's the thing. Here's one thing I know about him is he loves to take things off of me. He loves to be helpful. He loves to do all that. And so as soon as I saw it, I thought, oh no, he's going to feel so bad about this. But that's
probably a developed response. That's like.
Because it's true.
That's generous.
So anyway.
I do not deserve that. That's what she does. But when she does that, what does that do for me? It motivates me to not be such a whatever you call a person that does that over and over, you know? But that's what I mean. It's a generous explanation.
He means well.
And when a couple gets in a rhythm of generous explanation, there's almost a sense in which love is blind and in a healthy way.
Yeah.
And you're going to do something with those frustrations. But when both people lean into that, it's a powerful thing. So.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say about frustrations is one of the things I have actually learned from him, because he's masterful at it, is the whole idea of approach. When we're frustrated, when something happens again, or when something happens, our approach is everything. And my tendency is to just rush in and, you know, with the kids or whatever, and, you know, kind of take it, and then leave everybody bloody on the floor. So just, you know.
Her dad is a Marine, okay?
Right.
So
But approach is everything. And when we say approach, it's, you know, timing. It's thinking about mood. It's thinking about temperament. It's thinking about word choices. It's taking into consideration the other person and the situation and the variables that are at play, and approaching a conversation or approaching a difficult conversation, thinking about the timing and all of those things. We learned this with our kids and parenting, and it's huge with kids. Because all of you who have multiple children know they are so different. They come from the same gene pool possibly, but they are all completely different. So with Andrew, our oldest, the approach with him was always direct. You know, just give me the facts, tell me what you want me to do differently, I'm gonna do it. That was our oldest. Either one of us could talk to him, didn't matter. With our middle one, I learned with him that if I'm scratching his back, I could say anything to him, I could tell him things, I could correct things, and he would receive it. So our thing with him when a hard conversation needed to happen was it needed to be me, just because of our temperaments, and it needed to be during a back scratch. For Allie, our youngest, it was Andy. Andy was so good with her. He would go to her room, they would sing some Taylor Swift songs, you know, when she was in high school. And then he could just ease into that conversation. So approach is everything, even with our spouses. It really is just everything, because our goal isn't to be right. Our goal is to preserve the relationship. You can write somebody right out of a relationship. You can break a relationship simply because of your approach. But that's, you know, the goal isn't to correct. The goal is to build relationship.
And handling frustration the wrong way without taking approach, you know, can be the wedge, or frustration can build a relationship, but the approach is great.
Yeah, no, that's great. And when you have frustrations, so, I mean, you've talked about responses. our ultimate response typically needs to be that of forgiveness. So talk about what forgiveness has looked like in your marriage.
Forgiveness is a tricky thing. And Jeff has talked about this here, and you may have heard me talk about it before too. And again, if you're raised in a Christian environment, it's like, somebody get a call. That's okay. You can answer it. It's fine. Sorry. Sorry. Forgiveness. See, I forgive you. We had an example right here. That,
you know what?
Well, now you're going to have to forgive me for pointing you out. So we'll. It's a cycle.
It's bad when it's the preacher's wife, and it has happened to me more than once.
Yes. So the tricky thing about forgiveness is this. Forgiveness, you know, when we're hurt and we're angry, it creates somewhat of a debtor relationship. You know, you've taken something from me, and now you owe me, and now I'm mad. And so the key to forgiveness is, again, it goes back to pausing. And instead of just being mad and being angry and telling my story and you shouldn't have and you did this, it's asking the question, okay, what did this person take from me? Because I feel like they owe me something. And we even have language for this. You owe me an apology, okay? But specifically, what did they take? Did they take time? Did they take respect? Did they take my reputation in the community or with the family? Did they take my, you know, what did they take? Because if you and I can narrow it down to specifically what do I think they owe me, it makes it smaller, it makes it more manageable, and it makes it possible to forgive. I don't think you can really forgive a person if you haven't identified what they've taken from you. Yeah. That's why you have had the frustrating experience of, well, I've forgiven him. It's like, where's all that energy coming from? I don't know, but I forgave him. It's like, I don't think so, but anyway. Or you've even said, I tried to forgive. Well, the reason you keep throwing the words out there because we're Christians or you're a good person, you know you should forgive, until you identify what specifically, and sometimes it's a list that she took from me or he took from me during the season or during that conversation, it's very difficult then to say, okay, because forgiveness is, you know what, this is what he or she took. I am canceling that debt. I am deciding you don't owe me anymore. But I can't decide you don't owe me anymore until I've recognized what it is you owe me. And I know that sounds like a lot of gobbledygook. But again, the process of narrowing that down, especially in an ongoing relationship, and especially when in marriage, it's the same thing oftentimes, not every day or every week, but there's patterns. I mean, I tend to hurt Sandra the same way. It's not like I come up with new, inventive, creative things because, you know, when personalities clash, it's, you know. So when you have to forgive somebody for the same thing over and over, again, it's identifying, okay, I'm not going to let this become the whole relationship. Identify what it is. I'm choosing that you don't owe me. So I think understanding the dynamics of forgiveness is as important as forgiving in a relationship. And again, because it's, you know, there's daily interaction in a marriage, you've got to be able to narrow that down, or it just, again, it becomes the whole relationship. I don't know if that made sense or not.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And one thing that helped Jeff and I early on in our relationship was we learned about the 5 love languages. It's a book by Gary Chapman. If you haven't heard of it, you should get it because it was a game changer for us. It really helped us understand each other, how to communicate and love each other well. And I know that's been important with you guys as well. Talk through that and other tools and assessments that you guys have, you know, used to learn more about each other so that you can, you know, better your marriage and love each other really well.
Yeah, we live in a day and age with so many resources and so many things that are helpful.
Yeah.
One of the things, our small group just finished doing, I Said This, You Heard That, the new study on temperament. Some of y'all have done it.
How many of y'all have done that? I'm just curious.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
We actually have it out in the gift shop.
It was so great. It was really, really great for our small group. We just finished it. It was awesome. We wish we had that resource when our kids were younger, but highly recommend that. It's awesome. Any Enneagram people here? Yeah.
Okay,
so
make a noise.
Allie is an Enneagram person, so we've been learning all about Enneagram, and it has been, even after 30 years of marriage, I've learned that he's a 5, and for those of you who don't know Enneagram, that doesn't mean anything to you, but it has really been helpful to me, and I've learned that I'm a 1, So until recently, I didn't understand what's so hard about everybody ordering their world by, you know, color and size and, you know, just
labels.
And, you know, why doesn't everybody have a label maker? And what's so hard in your closet about sleeveless, short sleeve, three-quarter length, long sleeve? I just don't understand that.
I told her, don't use that when no one is ever going to invite you to their house if you talk that way.
So I've learned that about myself, too, which has allowed me to offer a little more grace. But that's been good. But yeah. Really, the five love languages that Wendy mentioned mm-hmm. was so good. We did that in one of our earliest small groups when our kids are, I don't even think we had Allie. We just had the boys. Mm-hmm. And they were little guys. And it was revolutionary because we learned he's quality of time. And I'm acts of service. And those two things can tend to clash a little bit. And we just learned how to love each other the way the other person needs to be loved, rather than me just serving, and he's over there lonely and sad because I won't talk to him. So those have been great for us.
Yeah.
And there's so many more.
We actually did the Five Love Languages book in our community group when our kids were super young, as you mentioned. And there was we had one particular incident that really was kind of revolutionary for me. I'll tell the story real quick. I think y'all have heard it before. So our small group had just left, and so we had two babies at the time. We had babies because we had a baby monitor, part of the story. So Sandra went upstairs, and you know, small group left, so there's dishes and coffee cups and stuff out. She goes upstairs to check on the kids, and so the baby monitor speaker is on the kitchen counter, and she's upstairs. And so I'm downstairs cleaning up the kitchen, and I have a tendency to clean up the kitchen loud. I think part of it is I want credit, so I want people to know I'm doing this. So the neighbors call, "Are you cleaning up the kitchen?" Cleaning out the dishwasher as loud as I can. Anyway, I don't think I was being loud on purpose, but all of a sudden, I hear the voice of God. It was actually Sandra upstairs, but it came through the speaker. Because you know how you have those things cranked up so you can hear just, so she's leaning down into the microphone upstairs, and here's what she said. She said, because she's acts of service, she said, "Do I hear someone down there loving me?" I know. And I'm telling you, a light switch went on in me. Not thanks for cleaning up the kitchen. See, because acts of service, it wasn't just cleaning up the kitchen so we can be efficient and go to bed early and get up early. It's, no, you have initiated service. And for me, this feels like love. And I'm telling you, it was like, oh, this isn't cleaning up the kitchen. Every time I clean out the dishwasher, this is like romantic for her. I was cleaning out. I'll clean up everything. It's unbelievable. Vacuuming. You sit down. I got this. You know. But it really, because our tendency is to love people, of course, the way we want to be loved. And I'm acts of service, so why can't we just go to a restaurant and talk all night till they run us out? And she's like, "We have things to do.
We're done eating. Why are we still sitting here?
We're finished eating. Why are we yet?" So just that tool was so revolutionary for us. And then the temperament study that some of you've done, I'll tell you, if you have children, because we knew a lot of it, I so wish we had had this tool that you have now when our kids were little, because of our three kids and their temperaments, we have a yellow. And if some of you know what a yellow is, they're super extroverted. They want to have fun. Who's going to be there? If they know, you know, it's just all about, and I'm not a fun person. Sandra's not that fun. I mean, we have fun, but we're not fun people.
But like, you should see their closets. So.
Yeah. We're very, so anyway, I would have done a much, much better job being a father to Garrett, our middle one, if I had had this frame of reference. I'm telling you, and I've told him that. I mean, we talk about it. So it's such a great tool. So please take advantage. We've been married 30 years, and again, just went through this temperament thing and the Enneagram thing. So helpful. So you got
to
take advantage.
And you don't have to have young kids. I mean, really, understanding temperament, we're able to use that with our adult kids.
And Enneagram,
too.
It's super helpful. Yeah. Enneagram's a little more complicated, but it's great.
And any way you can learn more about your spouse or kids is amazing. And we learned that early on because I'm words of affirmation and Wendy's quality time. So I would get up early and leave her notes at the coffee pot and all that, and just so excited that she was going to read these notes. And about 10 o'clock, I didn't hear from her. So I called her and said, "Did you not see my notes?" Right? To which she said, when are you going to be home? Yeah. So that's quality time.
Right?
And then I realized, oh, I'm loving you out of words of affirmation. So that's just, it's just really, really helpful.
Yeah,
so
it's been super helpful.
You were looking for some words of affirmation.
Which is so great.
I've learned that now.
That's how it works. Yeah. You play to your
Thank
own
you
strength.
For the note.
I think being a student of the people we love, mm-hmm. whether it's our spouse, our kids, our sister, our parents, being a student of the people we love and figuring out how to love them the way that they will receive it and feel it, yeah. is the most important thing.
Well, and you told us, Sandra, because this is so great about, you begin to learn not just about your spouse, you begin to learn about yourself.
Right.
Remember, you were a little disappointed with the color that you were.
I'm red. And so I didn't know I was red. I thought I was blue, and I was happy about being blue. And then I found out I was red. I had like a little identity crisis thing. And I was upset because nobody was surprised.
Yeah,
all
I had
the kids were
on
like,
red.
No.
That's awesome. Well, one of the principles that that we'd love for you to lean into is who you listen to is a preview of the future you. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to have Sandra and Andy here, listen to them. But we have an incredible counseling network of people that can speak wisdom, whether it's marriage, family, whatever. So let's talk about counseling. And Sandra, specifically, have y'all ever gone through counseling?
I've sent Andy. So does that count?
That does.
You get a check.
She's not kidding.
You can share about that.
About my counseling experience? Well, when we left, when I quit working for my dad, it was very tumultuous. Emotionally, it was public, it was crazy, and I was very angry. And my dad had a counselor actually named Steve, and so Steve invited me to meet with him under the auspices of kind of trying to reconnect and rebuild with my dad. And in my one-on-one time with Steve, he realized, whoo, you know, this young man needs some help, which I did. No, I did. And it was so life-giving, and it was so life-changing. And, women oftentimes are because I think just more relationally wired, it's easier for you to move in that direction. Men, we do not like to be told what to do. I mean, nobody really loves to be told what to do, but men tend to be more that way. This is one of the challenges for me and Jeff as pastors. We understand that, I mean, I you may have never felt this way. I feel this way on your behalf. To come to church every Sunday and sit in rows and have another man tell you how to live your life, and your wife's going, I mean, who wants that, right? Patting him on the knee. I mean, I know. It's like, great. So I'm an idiot, and Andy and Jeff know everything. I know. You really wish you were married to them and not me. No. So there is just weird dynamic. So men were a little bit more stubborn, and we're not as, I heard this quote, I can't say it exactly right, but they use this word influenceable and influenceability. We have lower influenceability. We are less inclined to be influenced by another person oftentimes than a woman. But we need it more, right? Because we're not as relationally intuitive, mm-hmm. sometimes. So yes, I started going to see a counselor, and then I would, sometimes at home things would kind of be revving up, and Sandra would just so gently say, I think you should go see Steve now. That's what she'd say. I think you need to go see Steve now. And I was at least, you know, connected enough to realize.
Sometimes it was more like, maybe you need to take that to Steve.
Maybe it was more like that, yeah. Because she's red. Anyway. And she was working that neck, I'm telling you. I was headed out the door to see Steve. Anyway. But Sandra didn't have an official counselor, but you had somebody who kind of played that role in your life as well.
I really did. When the boys were little, I identified a lady who had raised three boys, and she was a pastor's wife, so she had done, you know, decades of being a pastor's wife. And so basically I stalked her and harassed her until she agreed to meet with me. And she's been meeting with me really for about 25 years, just helping me navigate life in ministry and life as a mom and all of those things. So I think Andy and I both would say there is no shame in bringing a third party along, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a formal counselor, whether it's a couple a little further down the road than you are. There's just so much value in that. There is so much value in even learning how to do some of the things we've talked about before. Somebody who's been down the road and who's done that.
Yeah.
I think that's incredible, because the truth is your past will creep into your present, mm-hmm. and it will impact your future and the future of your kids and the future of the people that you love. So if there's stuff, you know, rattling around in there, please remember there's no shame in getting some help with it, getting it dealt with so that it doesn't creep out and get all over the people that you love, because that is the tendency.
Can I say one more thing about that? So when Sandra talks about having this woman pour into her, some of you young moms are thinking, I want a woman like that. And some of you older people like our age, whose kids are grown and gone, thought, oh, I wish I'd had someone like that. So I want to say something to all of you who are 40 and over. You should be that for younger people, younger men, younger women, younger couples. And you think to yourself, because we've had this discussion so many times, well, we don't really know anything. Yes, you do. If you want to find out how smart you are, and you've been married for 15 years, talk to someone who just got married. You'll be like, we are so smart. Because they don't know anything. And what they think they know, they're wrong. So you have a life. I mean, you go, oh, but we didn't do it well. Exactly. We learn more from people's mistakes than wrinkle-free perfect marriages. When you see somebody who has seemingly have a perfect marriage, you think, well, I can't do that. So leverage that pain, leverage that frustration, leverage that failed first marriage, leverage that prodigal son or daughter who finally came back. You know, you've got life experiences that are so valuable, and they are not going to have near the value they could have if you aren't willing to open your hands and make yourself available. And we have this incredible 2-to-1 program we do for young couples. But one of the things Sandra and I did for a year one time is we pulled out of our community group and we just visited young marriage groups and just said, ask us anything you want. And we would get in the car going, oh, we are so smart. Because, I mean, you don't know what you know. That's and you right. don't know what you've learned the hard way and the easy way until you're with it. So there is in the church, we should be the most mentored and life on life rich community in the world. Because again, we know what we wish we'd had. We can give that to somebody else. We know what we had. We give that to somebody else. So whether it's through the church, formally, informally, just would you consider, those of you, again, you're a little further along, making yourself available, not because you have a perfect story to tell, but because you have insight and knowledge you've gained that there's someone who, again, may be able to skip a whole season of their life or chapter of their life because of your willingness to invest.
And for some of us, our stories are our stewardship. You know, stewardship of our stories is leveraging what we've learned, leveraging what we've been through for the benefit of other people.
And often in church, we can be lulled to thinking that we're supposed to pretend that we have it all together. Mm-hmm. And if you're new to Gwinnett Church, we say, hey, this isn't a museum of perfect people. This is a hospital for broken people. And there are so many great mentors, potential great mentors here. Mm-hmm. They're awesome.
No, that's great. So to kind of pull it all together, there are essentially, for most marriages, 4 different stages you go through. So let's walk through those, and you tell us what you've learned from those seasons and kind of what each season entails and what you've walked away learning. So starting with your newlywed season, you're newlywed, no kids, what was that like?
It's hard to even remember. Sorry to remember that.
I'll tell you what, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it kind of goes back to what we just talked about. We really did identify some couples and some individuals that we wanted to ask to pour into us, and we just decided to kind of be bold and
took
ask.
Took them to dinner.
Took them to dinner, yep, and met with them and learned, and that was a big thing for us during that season, because one of our goals was we really want to get this right. We want to get the marriage thing right. We want to get the parenting thing right. That was a goal for us, and one of the ways in that newlywed season was to surround ourselves with some people who, to us, from the perspective where we were, looked like they were getting it right and had some things that we would want to learn. So we did that, and we even invited them into our small group from time to time, because we've done small group almost our whole marriage, and we would invite these, you know, couples a little further down the road to come in, and that was what
just
sparked
to answer
our idea.
Questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Just let us pepper you with questions.
And the other thing we did, and a lot of you doing this, is we served, because when we were early married, didn't have kids, and we were super involved in the church, and we were super involved in student ministry, mm-hmm. and just took all that extra time and energy and just really poured it. And some of, we say all the
students.
Time, some of our, probably our most fruitful season of our, quote, ministry life together was those pre-children years working with high school students who are now grown and have kids and teenagers and college students of their own. And because we've stayed in the Atlanta area all these years, to see that multiplier in
it's
terms of
fun.
Pouring into high school students, mm-hmm. it's just an incredible, that was an incredible investment.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, no, that's good to take advantage of that time you have, because then you have kids.
Yeah.
And you lose all of that time.
Yeah.
So talk us through that season and what that looked like for you guys with small children.
That season was exhausting. And, you know, when you think about just little kids, it's physically exhausting. And for those of you who are in the little kid season, I'll just say to you, it does get better when they get to be teenagers. It just becomes mental.
Yeah.
So it's different. But during those early parenting years, we just decided there's some categories of things that we're going to say no to. We kind of had some categorical no's because we just wanted to be able to be present in raising our kids. We wanted to be able to be to not miss the good stuff because you know, as parents, that you move out of a season, you don't get that back. And if you miss it, you miss it, and you just don't get it back. So we kind of developed some categorical no's. Andy said no to almost every kind of traveling during those years just because, you know, it wasn't a part of what he had to do. It was opportunities, but we just decided this is a no for now, not for always. And as a mom, I did the same thing and just kind of backed away from some things for a while.
And we prioritized in those years eating dinner at home. I think that was when people ask, you know, Andy, what was the thing? Was it, family devotions? I'm like, no, they were kind of lame, obviously. I just was not a good family. But we had dinner at home because the goal of dinner is not eating. It's conversations that only happen at a dinner table. And you don't get that at a restaurant like you do at home. And not that everybody has to be a cook, but, you know, or, you know, love to cook. But that, I just think those consistent years at home, having dinner with our kids, was huge in terms of reconnecting and keeping them connected.
Right, and as you all know who have kids, it gets busier and busier and harder to do that. So as our kids got a little bit older and had activities and stuff, I would text everybody, group text, and say, okay, this week, dinner at home Monday night and Thursday night,
don't plan anything.
Or whatever. Don't plan anything those nights, just to be intentional about making sure that we had that time. Because as they got older, everybody—I don't know who told them they could have lives of their own, but they did. So
they were running from those closets. Right. So
probably there is that.
No. So then they do grow up to be teenagers. Talk about those years.
Yeah. Again, temperament, understanding. I mean, that's a big thing. When we look back, we think, wow, if we could have understood temperament back then, it would have changed some things, particularly for the one that was most different from us. Mm-hmm. So that was a big one. And then...
Yeah, we learned this from Shanti Feldhahn's book. I don't remember the name of the book.
For Parents Only.
If you haven't read For Parents Only, little tiny book, incredible book. And in there, she talked about during the teenage years, the number one rule is don't freak out. Don't freak out. Don't freak out.
Because they're going to tell you stuff that's going to make you want to freak out.
Yeah. And if you freak out, they don't talk anymore. And it was great. It was like, don't freak out like over cheer at the ball game. That's freaking out. And don't freak out like when they tell you something bad that happened at the neighbor's house. Just never freak out. Just be like, oh. So when you put out the fire, then what did y'all do? You know, you just never freak out. And I'm telling you, we held, and they would get up and go upstairs to do homework from the dinner table, and we'd be looking at each other like, after a while, we didn't even have to say it, but our thought was, would you have told your parents that when you were a teenager? Never, because they would have freaked out and shut it down. We're just like, that's great, you know? We learned, so yeah, don't freak out. I think that's all I remember from those years.
You can freak out when they leave the room. Oh my gosh, what are we gonna do?
Yeah. No, and then empty nesters.
Yes, yes. Woo-hoo. You're
great.
Into it's that awesome. Now.
Even the kids' closets are clean now. It's amazing.
Right, everybody's. You know, I would say in this season that we're in now and kind of looking back, invest in the kind of relationship you want to have when you're an empty nester. And that means even during those busy years, you look at your kids and say, you know what, mom and dad are having a conversation right now, we'll talk to you in a few minutes. Or we would hit the road and go out of town by ourselves regularly, you know, at least once or twice a year without kids. Because we did have a goal of wanting to still like each other a lot when our kids were out of the house. And we have loved these empty nester years. Because
swinging back around to the big theme of goals, and I won't tell this whole story because it's too long, but after Andrew was born, we're on our way to vacation, we had a long conversation about, oh my gosh, we have a child and what are we going to do? And we set a goal that really became the North Star specifically for our parenting, but it certainly impacted our relationship as well. And our North Star goal for our family was that our kids would want to be with each other and with us when they no longer had to be. That our kids would want to be with each other and with us when they no longer had to be. That when they grew up and were on their own, that they would still enjoy being together and enjoy being with us. So that really, and I'm telling you, And I got that from Sandra's family because they were that way. And I thought, that is the win. Mm-hmm. So we parented through that grid. We tried to manage our relationship through that grid. We managed how they treated each other through that grid. And so now we're on the other side of that. And our kids love to be together, and they at least appeared to love to be with us. And I'm telling you.
And it wasn't perfect and beautiful either. I mean, they did not prefer each other during certain seasons of life.
Yeah.
And it did come back around. So it's not like, oh, well, that's easy for you to say because you have kind of a wrinkle-free.
But having that North Star as a family, and again, measuring things against it.
And just having a grid of through which to make decisions as it relates to wanting to get there.
Yeah, made a big difference.
Sure. Anything you'd do differently?
I would. I know two things. I wrote down two things.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would not be so uptight when my kids were little about just being children. I wish I had played more. Again, I'm not a fun person. I can be funny, but I'm not fun. I wish I had been more of a playful person. And I'll tell you where I was reminded of this real quick. We fostered, and so at one point we had three little girls living with us who were 5, 7, and 8.
They were 5, 11, and 12.
5, 11, and 12.
It's close. But there was a 5-year-old.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's who I want to tell you about. So she was 5, and they're foster kids, so won't go into all that, but she, when she came into our home, somebody had given her roller skates and she'd never skated outside with them. And we would, just to keep her entertained, I would let her roller skate in our house. Like around the kitchen island, down the living room, all across the hardwoods and run across the carpet, you know, just her name's, can I say her? Well, anyway.
No, she's not 18
she's
yet.
She's not 18 yet. But anyway, she just roller skate. Well, our kids who are all older would come over and they would be like,
no, they would say,
have you?
Dad, you didn't even let us run in the house.
And she's like, ah, we'll fix the floors, whatever, you know. And as she would just, you know, roller skate around the house, I would think to myself, I wish I had been more that way. And then the other thing, my other regret, is when my kids were teenagers, I wish I had engaged more with their friends. I knew their friends' names kind of, but I just didn't engage. I would go back and be more engaging with my kids' teenage friends. They may not want me to, but I saw other dads do a great job at that appropriately, and I just thought, oh, I wish I was more like that. So.
Yeah.
And we certainly have that as well. When I used to drive the kids to school, I would make them listen to Success Magazine CDs. And I thought, that's a fantastic thing. And now I realize that's what they're going to be in counseling for.
Yeah.
So you're not fun either.
No, I'm not fun either. But Wendy can tell you that.
I'm fun.
Wendy's a fun one of the four of us.
There's one before. Well, Gwinnett Church, Hamilton Mill, and Sugar Hill, hasn't this been amazing? Can y'all... Andy, I'd love for you to pray for us and just close us out. And we're grateful for y'all kicking off the season.
Absolutely. And Hamilton Mill, I don't know where the camera is, but you guys, we're so amazed.
And excited.
And excited for you and what's going on over there and what happened last weekend at Easter. Mm-hmm. And thanks for loving that community and thanks for loving each other and thanks for being a part of, you know, what God's doing in our city and in Gwinnett County and in the world. So let's pray together. Father, thank you for our families. Thank you for the good and the bad. Thank you for the regrets. Thank you for what we learned from those. Father, thank you even for a bit of the dysfunction that causes us to get on our knees and not only just pray hard, but for some of us, pray for the first time in a long time. And you have a way of causing us to lift our eyes when things spin out of control and we cannot control another person. We all confess we have a hard time controlling ourselves, or controlling us. So just give us the grace to see each other the way that you do. I pray that every husband listening would give him eyes to see his wife the way you see her and to respond appropriately the same way. And every married woman, to give her the eyes to see her husband the way that you see him and to respond correctly. And help us to see our kids the same way as well, because at the end of the day, we are all your children. And Sandra is your daughter before she's my wife. Mm-hmm. And my children are your sons and daughters before they're even my children. And so give us that perspective and then give us the grace to respond appropriately. And we love you so much in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.
Next week, we're going to be talking about work and career goals. A mutual friend of ours, Cliff Robinson, who's the senior VP of operations for Chick-fil-A, maybe you've heard of them, is going to be here. And we're going to be talking about work and career, so don't miss that. Until then, have a great week. We'll see you next Sunday.